This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. The year is 1869, and a 24-year-old doctoral student at the University of Leipzig, on the basis of a strong letter of recommendation from his advisor, receives an offer of a chair in classical philology at the University of Basel in Switzerland. Thanks to that offer, he's granted a doctoral degree without writing a dissertation. How good is good? 1 year later, he is promoted to full professor at Basel University. That same year, 1870, the Franco-Prussian War breaks out. He enlists on the German side, and while serving on the front, he writes an essay called The Dionysian Worldview, which was never published. 2 years later, he published The Birth of Tragedy. Nietzsche was 27 years old, and that book essentially aborted his academic career. Stay tuned. A show on the birth of tragedy coming up. I'm especially pleased to be joined today by Andrew J. Mitchell, whom I hold in as high esteem as any philosopher who has not yet passed over to the other side. Andrew Mitchell was a frequent guest on Entitled Opinions in the early years, when he was a teaching fellow here at Stanford. Today, he is professor of philosophy at Emory University, who works on post-Kantian German philosophy with a focus on aesthetics and metaphysics. He's a prodigious translator, as well as the author of two major books on Heidegger, but we'll save that discussion for another time when we get Andrew back to talk about his splendid book, The Fourfold, Reading the Late Heidegger. Andrew, by my calculation, it's been 12 years since our last confession. It's great to have you back on Entitled Opinions.
Wow, if that's true, it means I've aged. So I don't like confronting that fact. Yeah, thanks for having me, Robert. It's great to be back.
You and your co-translator, Sean Kirkland, have just retranslated The Birth of Tragedy in English for Volume 1 of The Complete Works of Nietzsche.
Yeah.
The Complete Works of Friedrich Nietzsche, exact title. It's a multi-volume, critical, scholarly edition which Stanford University Press has finally, after a lot of delay, started to bring out in English. Yeah. The Complete Works of Nietzsche is a very entangled affair, I gather, both here and in Europe. And we don't want to get bogged down in editorial history, but can you tell us which early writings of Nietzsche are contained in the two volumes that you and Sean are translating?
Yeah, thanks. Well, it has all of his early writings from 1870 through 1873-74. This includes The Birth of Tragedy, sort of the centerpiece, but all of the essays leading up to that. Two public lectures he gave in Basel on the Greek music drama or Socrates and tragedy. It has the Dionysian worldview essay, which is where he first introduces the figure of Dionysus into his thinking. It has a book he wrote somewhat under the prompting of Wagner called On the Future of Our Educational Institutions, but then he decided not to publish. It has five prefaces to five unwritten books, which is sort of a Borgesian kind of compilation of prefaces that includes Homer's Contest, a famous essay people might know. It has his book, Philosophy and the Tragic Age of the Greeks, and it has the essay on Truth and Lies in an Extramoral Sense.
That's a
plus,
that sounds
you know, like, there's 500 pages of notes supporting all these.
Amazing. That's a lot of text and some really crucial ones there.
Yeah, I was honored to be able to do it. It's a dream come true.
I can imagine. Before we talk about The Birth of Tragedy, the I have never read the essay about the Dionysian worldview. Is that interesting as a prelude to The Birth of Tragedy?
Oh, absolutely. It's amazing. I mean, one of the things you learn from reading these early essays is the genesis of the thinking of Birth of Tragedy. And most people think of Birth of Tragedy as, in a sense, about the Apollonian-Dionysian distinction. But Nietzsche's early thinking of the Greeks wasn't about that at all. Like the first essay we have, or the first lecture, is from 1870, the Greek music drama. And even the name signals that this is Wagnerian. You know, music drama is associated with Wagner. And he's looking at tragedy as an example of Wagnerian music drama. The second public lecture has the criticisms of Socrates we're familiar with to a certain extent. But then, as you said, after the outbreak of the war, Dionysian worldview gives us a rethinking of the whole Greek milieu with the introduction of Dionysus as this figure of excess, or of what he calls the vernal drive, the Frühlingstrieb, you know, the spring desire for coupling and mating and so forth. And that's where we first get this antagonistic opposition or this cooperation, antagonistic cooperation of the Dionysian and the Apollonian that becomes the centerpiece of The Birth of Tragedy.
I'm curious about his experience in the Franco-Prussian War, where he enlisted in the nursing service because he had actually become a Swiss citizen in order to teach at Basel University.
Yeah.
So yeah. He couldn't actually enlist as a, you know, for combat. And he experienced some horrors there, seeing mutilated bodies. He describes these in letters, and he's really looked at you know, the horrible in a very direct way. I'm wondering, does that have something to do with his writing about Dionysus at the front, you know, where he speaks in The Birth of Tragedy about Dionysus is also a god of horror in many ways, no?
Absolutely. It's shocking to see his life playing out the same logic of the book. He writes about the horrors of the Battle of Worth. Yeah, just briefly on the Franco-Prussian War, this was a battle where Bismarck sort of provoked the French into attacking the Germans. There was no Germany at the time. It was a collection of principalities, of Prussia being the largest, most dominant, and Bismarck was there. And he leaked sort of an insult against a French diplomat and made sure it was promulgated in the press. And this led the French with, ruffled egos to proclaim war, and that allowed Bismarck to unify Germany. That led to the unification of Germany. The siege around Paris led to the collapse of the government there and the formation of the Paris Commune. So it's a significant historical event. And Nietzsche writes, he was serving as a kind of field medic, driving, transporting ailing combatants to hospitals. And he writes to his mother about the horrors that he's seeing. And there's a passage where he writes that it's so overwhelming that he's throwing himself into his academic plans for the coming year, where he's going to be teaching Greek rhetoric or Greek meter and rhythm. And so we even have the notebook that he kept at that time, and you could see a facsimile of it on NietzscheSource.org. And you could see there's notes about Dionysus and the Greek things, and then suddenly it breaks into some rhythmic considerations of Greek poetry. It's fascinating. So he's seeking this kind of Apollonian buffer against this Dionysian excess.
Right.
He's even, the French introduced a new kind of rifle in that battle. I forget what it was called, chasseur or something. And he would pick up the spent shells of this French rifle and send it to his friends and even his mother as a souvenir from the field. In that whole process, he contracted pharyngeal, what do they call it? He had dysentery and a kind of
diphtheria.
Yeah. So he was explosive from two directions. And I think he might have had some medical complaint before that, but I think this event was sort of the beginning of his lifelong troubles at a biological medical level.
Yeah. Did he also contract syphilis during that war?
That I'm not sure of or can't confirm, well, but he had enough going on without
it. He had enough. So there's also this France-Germany dynamic that we really should talk about, because it's something there also in The Birth of Tragedy, I believe, where this sort of tribute to Wagner, this sort of idolization of the spirit of German music and the resurrection of the German spirit, as it were, and France representing very much, the counter power and the more established power in Europe at the time. To what extent is there German nationalism at work in Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy, which he would then quickly repudiate later?
Yeah, in a few years. But it's 100% German nationalist, I would say, and very much anti-French. So the French were the cultural elite. They dominated cultural discussion. The Germans aped French manner. Right? This is all... Everyone was like in the court of the Sun King, you know, trying to comply and conform to French dictates, French custom, French fashion and style for, you know, obvious reasons. But that kept the German submerged and without sort of a voice of their own. And so we like to think of Nietzsche as, you know, the good European, as he says, but he was not very much a good European at this time. He was anti-French, anti-Italian, anti-Romance in a sense, Romance language, Romance culture, and pro-German. And this is throughout the book and explicitly in the last third of the book. Even the critique of Euripides, which we'll get into, Euripides was the favored classical tragedian of Racine. Racine, the court tragedian of Louis XIV. And the attack on, if you, any Racine play you read has a preface where he extols how great Euripides is.
Yeah.
So even the critique of Euripides is kind of a slap in the face of French culture.
Right. Well, that's great. We'll get into these issues maybe a little further. We're kind of ahead of ourselves, because here, as I mentioned, this guy, 24 years old, gets his superlative letter of recommendation by Ritschl, I think was his dissertation advisor.
Yeah.
And he gets this amazing offer, and he's supposed to be the wonder philologist, and he has not published very much at all, just a couple of essays, I think, in Ritschl's journal. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, in 1872, comes out with this book on Greek tragedy, where he is now, everyone was expecting him to establish, you know, these kind of superlative credentials that he had, on the basis of which he had received that offer. And instead, he publishes a book which is by any measure a rather, what could I say, it's dismissive of the very discipline of classical philology as the German academia had understood it up until then. It's a very bizarre first book to publish for someone in his position. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to understand what philology is. I mean, it's, what is it? It's sort of the study of the history of languages and grammatical changes. A philologist would, I don't know, look at papyri and do source work and try to speculate about, or maybe not speculate, but sort of sketch out where a missing papyrus has a variant of a text that makes it into a subsequent one, or how Greek grammar has changed, how diphthongs emerge or the digamma and then they disappear. It's the epitome of the dustiest, most scholarly, hidebound kind of work you could possibly do in the academy. It makes like grammar look sexy. It's dry, and it's there's a kind of humility about it in that. But there's also huge egos at stake, because there's a unquestioned authority in German 19th century academic life that goes with it. So expectations were for more of this sort of edition work and careful, meticulous scholarship. And that's exactly what you don't get in The Birth of Tragedy, right? There's no footnotes in the book, for one. Worse, he never cites anything in ancient Greek, right? There's no Greek. But with the notebooks, I'll show that he's working with ancient Greek terms and so forth at this time, but the book has no evidence of that. Section one starts with a long quotation from Wagner's Meistersinger is in it, right? And he quotes, I think the person most quoted in the book is Goethe, and then second most after that, Wagner, which isn't common for philological work in the 19th century or any other. It would be like if I were an ancient Egyptologist and my book comes out and I'm citing, you know, Kanye West talking about having sex with the pharaoh, or I talk about baking kamut bread, you know, the grain that was supposedly from Egyptian tombs. Or even worse than that, I talk about rumors that the first bakers of this grain, how they used to think about the world or something. The book's insane. It's what he counts as source material for his claims, or what he counts as evidence for his claims, is nothing that would ever stand a academic test. You know, he's talking about rumors in ancient Greece about this or that, or he talks about in his dreams he's had this experience, and everyone would agree that you realize you're dreaming and cry out, I want to dream on. And then he uses that as the basis for conclusions that he draws from it. It's anything but scholarly.
So basically, it's a book that could have been written by someone who was not a classicist at all, perhaps, right? or is that going too far?
Exactly. No, I think that's right. I think a Wagnerian. You'd have to be a particular Wagnerian to write it, I think.
And then he offers some translations, that are also bewildering.
Yeah, he uses published translations when he cites things, which isn't, you know, if you're trying to show your, you know, how great of a philologist you are, up and coming, you would probably want to cite this material in the original, or if you're going to even deign to give a translation, have it be your own that was, you know, very close to the original, close to being literal. And we have something completely different. It's just whatever published popular translation happens to be at hand, he's citing. He has the Greek text in his personal library. You know, we have an index of everything he had in the library. But he cites popular translations, sometimes that are rather paraphrastic.
Yeah. Well, so two questions. Did he do this out of a sense of irresponsibility, that he was so enraptured with Wagner and his budding friendship with Wagner, and that he just got swept away with this tide of romanticism in his soul, and he just neglected? Or was he trying to really make a statement to the profession or to whoever that he had no intention to become a typical a philologist of that sort?
Yeah, they're not exclusive. It's both. He's trying to make an argument that can't be proven, or is about the unprovable in some sense, and he's not shy about it.
So let's talk a little bit about the argument now, Andrew, because it's for all its defects as a work of philology, the Birth of Tragedy is a major. Work for classicism still today, and way beyond, you know, the profession of the classics. So there is some kind of explosive insight that the book brings out, especially in the context of 19th century idealization of the Greeks as all about order and measure and beauty and restraint, and that whole kind of Goethean vision.
Winckelmann. Noble simplicity and quiet grandeur. Yeah.
Exactly. And so what are the contributions it makes that have assured that this book is still being read and will continue to be read? What, even though he doesn't provide a lot of evidence for his arguments seem to have some kind of solid basis in the Greek experience.
Yeah. Well, it's all the Greeks have stood for a kind of formalism. You know, as you mentioned Goethe, this kind of Weimar classicism is all about form, self-control, containment, transparency, self-knowledge. Goethe's Iphigenia and Tauris, for example, he rewrites the Euripidean play, and every character speaks perfectly their mind, totally, clearly, and transparently. It brings tears to your eyes to see the how genuine someone can be, that they know fully who they are, what they want to say, and they say it elegantly. It's perfectly contained, formally beautiful. That's exactly what Nietzsche explodes in The Birth of Tragedy. The emphasis is on excess, the irrational, what interrupts and destroys the form, right? Form is just one side of the equation, and in fact, a derivative one, a reaction against the formless, seething undercurrent of the Dionysian. And this notion of the Dionysian is, in a sense, the key here.
Yeah. How much of his concept of the god Dionysus as the god of excess, of intoxication, of primordial unity, even pre-formal, oneness of being. Yeah. How much of his concept of Dionysus is indebted to Schopenhauer, who looms large in The Birth of Tragedy, obviously, and his thesis about the world as will and representation, where, I mean, I think it's too easy to say, well, yeah, Dionysus stands for the will and Apollo for the world of representation or, measure and form and so forth.
There's a certain amount of truth to that.
Yeah,
Schopenhauer modulated through Wagner. And so the metaphysics of the book, what he calls the artist's metaphysics, is sort of taken from Schopenhauer's notion of the will, but translated into what he calls life.
Yeah.
And so life becomes the matter of, dispersal and recuperation. There's individuals all around. We're all individual, and everything individual, everything dies. And that death is horrible and hard to bear, right? This is the Selenian wisdom that best is not to have been born, second best to die young. I say third best to smoke. But, but the horror of confronting that idea of your own death or the meaninglessness of life, that's part of life for him. So when we die, we return to that natural unity. There's a dispersal into individuals, and then nature recuperates that. So he's thinking of this expansion and contraction of nature, or this dispersal and recuperation of the many and the one, as a dynamic that we don't need to fear. The key to tragedy for him, or the purpose of tragedy for him, is in a sense a consoling one. It provides solace for life, because we see that even in this death of the individual, we return to a prior whole, and that this punctuated syncopation of life is to be celebrated. Nothing is, in a sense, lost. It's reclaimed, and it makes its way back to its home in nature. And this is exactly what he ultimately comes to reject later, as he makes clear in the preface to the book.
Yeah, that preface being written, 14 years later? I don't know how many.
Yeah, 14. 16, exactly. 14 years. The idea is really that tragedy shows the individual hero and the chorus the chorus functions as a communal group and ready to experience the hero as individual, but then that individual hero ultimately dies, suffers a downfall, and that's the collapse of the individuated particular. And so tragedy is like a celebration of the syncopation of nature, and that provides solace.
Yeah. When you say it's a celebration, is that maybe going too far, given that the subtitle of the book is Hellenism and Pessimism, and that he's maybe suggesting that we can affirm life despite, you know, the horrors that it entails and despite all the endless misery and suffering that life is all about, that that without celebrating it, you can actually affirm it as something that must be born, and yet at the same time, it's not a reason to turn against it nihilistically, or, you know, in some sense, it's not even a search for consolation for the suffering of life, but trying to find what is most alive within the experience of suffering itself.
I think that's true, and I think everything you said is true, and that's what we want it to be, except for it is explicitly presented as a consolation and a solace. And that, so everything else about the affirmation of life, he'll carry that forward, but thinking that there was something that needed to be corrected in the first part is, in the first place, is what he rejects.
Yeah. So in the first part of the book, I mean, I think the book really gets underway around, you know, section 6, 7, 8, 9. That's when he kind of, all the fluff that begins, I don't know, fluff is, but it somehow, he gets to the core of his understanding, not only of Greek tragedy, but of the rise of Socratic philosophy in those sections, let's say, between 8, you know, 7 and 15, 16.
Okay,
so we have the Dionysian Apollonian dialectic, and we don't have to rehearse that. I think most people are familiar with, you know, Dionysus and Apollo. We have the role that music plays as the origin of tragedy, where it would have been like the chorus. And this chorus, as far as I understand Nietzsche, it's not that there was a performance originally, but that the whole community, a small, you know, village community, they would all be dancing, swaying, and be under the spell of the god, I mean, the presence of the god of Dionysus, maybe the spring thing where you get a kind of group intoxication. And Nietzsche suggests that out of that spirit of dance and music would emerge almost magically some kind of the hero, you know, the hero of the play. And that hero would be sacrificed, the downfall, as you mentioned. And that it was all a kind of somewhat psychedelic experience in the most primordial sense, no?
Well, he compares it to St. Vitus dancers and pandemics of this sort, of dancing with Tarantella and all of this sort of thing. But yeah, the Dionysian is a kind of formlessness versus the individuation of the Apollonian form. And music is lauded as this non-representational art par excellence. And it's contrasted with the image-making arts. And the image-making arts are definite and have, you know, lines that you're not supposed to color out of and so forth. And that's on the side of Apollo, and sculpture as well, you know, highly articulated things. Whereas music is non-representational. Music is the universal of which images can only ever be one particular example or representation. He thinks this in with regards to Wagner and the opera Tristan and Isolde, like sections 19 and 20, if I recall. He says, could anyone ever withstand hearing Act 3 of Wagner's Tristan with you know, with no imagery? It would overwhelm you. It would change you. In one of the early drafts of it, he says it would change my notion of the human if someone were able to endure this amazing music without the images. And so the Dionysian needs that Apollonian image, or needs that language, in order to express how it's beyond that language or beyond that image. And he sees music as being that beyond, in a way, music operating through dissonance or in a non-rational way. I mean, what he hates most is when music tries to be representational in a kind of one-to-one basis, what's called, you know, tone painting, right, where the music apes the sound of what's happening in the action or something like that. That's the worst. That's subordinating this sovereign, non-representational art to serve a particular individuated purpose.
Right. And what about dancing, Andrew? Because we have here Dionysus, who's associated with the satyrs, who were these goat men. Yeah. And he says that to consider them subhuman is wrong. No, they are more than human because they combine the human with nature, the vitality of nature. And the satyrs are also dancers. So I think that dancing as the enlisting of the body into the spirit of music is as important as the music itself.
Yeah. The other side of the criticism would be the criticism of the spectator. And I think you could oppose the dancer to the spectator on just this point. The satyr is interesting because he says that they exist outside civilization on the periphery of it, always there in some sense. And this is what opera sort of tried to return to. Like, it's not accidental that he talks about opera in the book, because opera from its outset envisioned itself as a retrieval of ancient Greek tragedy. You know more about this than me, the Florentine Camerata in the 16th century, the Florentine Camerata, where they devised opera. I think it arose where the leader of the group, this guy Bardi, had read so much about how great tragedies were. And then, you know, about the amazing effect they had on the audience. And then he read one and thought, meh, you know, what's the big deal? I must be missing something. And it must be that these weren't read texts. They were rather sung or performed. And so that led to the invention of what we call recitative or song speech, where, you know, the dialogue in an opera is sort of half sung, half spoken. And they thought that must have been what made opera work. And so what Nietzsche says is that these Italian inventors of the opera imagined the primordial human as this singing figure. You know, you find this in Rousseau or in Herder, that language arose out of song.
Yeah, Vico, and, too. That's not... Vico was the first one to have that perception.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But all of this he sees as kind of a bogus idealization of and creation of some presumable idyllic past. So that original singing figure has nothing in common with the satyr. The satyr was reveling in the Dionysian dissolution of boundaries versus these sort of comfortable bourgeois kind of imagined idyllic singing figures of Italian opera. He sees them as that those Italian operas are the presumed ancient source is idyllic in a way that's naively idyllic as a counterpode to a Christian despisal of the body or dismissal of the body. Just as there's like an original sin for Christians, this is just the counterfoil to that. And they both remain locked in that same duality that the satyr is already outside of.
Yeah, you know, my own very problematic relation to opera is I have to say that I just have an allergy to it. I just can't endure it. For me, it's always at a pitch of hysteria. And the fact that it's based on this misunderstanding, basically a misreading of Aristotle's Poetics, where they read the Poetics and they thought that Aristotle was saying that both the chorus and the actors' parts were sung. And as you say, it's a form, opera becomes a form of entertainment.
Yeah.
And a form of comfort, whereas the satyr and the reveling, that is a, you know, a very different scene. I think it's priapic and it's dangerous.
And this is why Wagner doesn't refer to his work as opera, but always struggles to find a name. He calls them theatrical stage festival plays or something. He's always seeking a name other than opera.
Right.
The musical dramas.
Exactly. Well, Good. So we've covered a good deal about the Dionysian and the Apollonian, that relation. The other major insight I think we get in The Birth of Tragedy is how this relates to the rise of Socratic philosophy.
Yeah.
And the figure of Socrates emerges here as almost a co-equal along with Dionysus and Apollo. And he's almost like another god that comes on the scene in Absolutely. Greece, but very antagonistic to his tragic counterparts, no?
Yeah, I mean, the first third of the book, you could say the opposition is Dionysus and Apollo, this formlessness and form, dissolution and individuation. But then he says, historically, the opposition changes, no longer Dionysus, Apollo, but Dionysus, Socrates.
Yeah.
And so he is put explicitly on a par with that. And how he understands Socrates is as a kind of rationalist who wants an explanation for everything. And he allies Socrates and Euripides. So in Greek tragedy, we have Aeschylus with the Oresteia, you have Sophocles with the Theban plays, and then you have Euripides. And the genre determinations start to break down with him. Some things are more like melodrama with him. There's not an explicit tragic thing. For Nietzsche, it's the introduction of a kind of rationalism into tragedy that undermines everything good about it, that there was something perplexing or inconceivable in Aeschylus and Sophocles. The characters aren't fully formed, or they act in ways that aren't maybe 100% predictable. What he says that all of the figures of Aeschylean and Sophoclean tragedy have like a comet's tail on them. They're not clearly defined. They sort of trail off in a way. And that is what drove Euripides crazy, Nietzsche says. I mean, there's no way to know this, right? This is sort of the kind of logic of the text. So it's beyond ad hominem argument. It's like creating this character and making him do things and putting thoughts in his head and then criticizing those. So Euripides sits in the theater and realizes he can't understand his forebearers and sets about trying to make things concrete and specified. So you have the deus ex machina that comes at the end of the play, right? Or at the start of the play, a god will come out, or Heracles will come out and tell you what's going to happen. So that, like, puts a kibosh in any kind of dramatic suspense. It's not about dramatic suspense, because I've just been told what's going to happen. At the end of a play, like in Euripides' Orestes, I think, one guy has a knife at the throat of Electra, other people are fighting, and then suddenly a god appears and says, enough, you two, you're going to be married, so he drops the knife, and oh, how nice, and you two, you're actually brothers, and what have you, and everything gets resolved sort of on the spot, and it's tidy.
Yeah.
And that tidiness is like this intellectual tidiness, this need for the logically controllable that he sees emerging with Socrates. And it goes on, and it's utterly opposed to Dionysian excess in a way that Apollo never was. Apollo is seen as a kind of negotiation with it, or an admission of it. Apollo needs Dionysus in the way Dionysus needs Apollo.
Right, because Apollo is also a container of Dionysus.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it allows Dionysus to show itself through the excess of it. Yeah. Whereas with Socrates and Euripides, this idea becomes more insulated and just caught up in its own involutions. It's a snake chasing its tail, he says. It doesn't recognize any outside beyond its own logical domination.
So would you say, because you're using Euripides and Socrates almost interchangeably, which is Nietzsche, what Nietzsche does. So is it fair to say that for Nietzsche, Euripides rationalized tragedy? Would that be?
I think that's fair.
And that would be the Socratic part of him that he... But to rationalize tragedy is to indeed completely betray the very essence of tragedy, as Nietzsche understood it, which is the forces of the irrational that are in constant contest with the Apollonian power of restraint and
the subordination of everyone to fate. Even the gods have to bow to fate, and fate isn't rational or something you can work out on a piece of paper with formulas or equations. Fate demands what it demands, and you suffer what it dictates.
So on the one hand, Nietzsche's understanding of Socrates or Socratism in The Birth of Tragedy is as a symptom of the decline of Greek culture, of the high point of Greek culture, because it no longer has the inner strength to affirm life in the face of the horrors and meaninglessness and absurdity of life, and that it's a kind of retreat, and therefore it's already indicating decadence, a certain kind of falling.
It excludes that horror in advance.
It does.
It doesn't overcome it like the Apollonian did. Yes. It just excludes it and avoids it and pretends it's not there.
Yeah.
He sees Socrates, his vision of Socrates in this book, because it's different in like Twilight of the Idols later, is, you know, the idea that we only make errors or we do wrong out of ignorance. If we knew better, we would always do the right thing. So it's always intellectual. It's always at the cognitive level. He sees Socrates as the champion of intellectual cognition, of self-knowledge in the most sort of banal sense.
At the same time, Socrates, he has this paradoxical admiration at this for Socrates too, because he knows that Socrates cannot be reduced to just that one characterization because of Socratic irony. And my feeling is that Nietzsche understood that the irony of Socrates was a certain kind of creative retrieval or inheritance of the tragic irony of the dramatists, that Socrates had too much self-awareness to not know that the attempt to rationalize as he was doing was not doomed to some kind of ultimate failure, that the irrational was always going to win out in the end, despite the most heroic efforts of the philosopher.
He talks about how on his deathbed, as depicted in the Phaedo, Socrates heard his daemon say to him, you know, Socrates, make music. And he started trying to, you know, make up for his sins against Dionysus by trying to make music. But the music that he made was setting some of Aesop's fables to music. Right? And the fable is a pretty anemic.
Right. But in fact,
it has a moral, right?
It has a moral.
It's pretty didactic.
And Nietzsche says that his Socrates' allegiance was to the fable, certainly not to the tragic.
Yeah. He praises him, in a sense, for inventing the novel. He thinks that the Socratic dialogue leads to the formation of kind of novel with dialogue and characters, etc. Yeah. So that's maybe the
Well, you know, I did a show on the symposium with Andrea Nightingale, our colleague and friend. You know her well.
Absolutely.
And there I remember, you know, we discussed how at the end of the symposium, Socrates there, drinking as much as everyone.
Yeah.
Alcibiades has crashed the party, and he is like the figure of Dionysus. He has the ivy, and he comes in drunk, and everything becomes dissolute, and there Socrates, even though he drinks as much as everyone else, maintains perfect sobriety, and it ends with him.
So much the worse for him.
Yeah, so much the worse for him. But he's there, you know, having a debate with both Agathon, the tragic poet, and Aristophanes, the comic poet, and getting them to agree that a really good poet can write a comedy as well as a tragedy. And in a certain sense, that's what Plato has done in the Symposium, where it's all very hilarious when you think that they're having highfalutin discourses about what is the essence of Eros, and when you get to the top of the ladder of this ideal, then Alcibiades breaks in and it becomes almost like a dissolute orgy. And at the same time, it's tragic because Alcibiades was a student of Socrates, and Socrates' whole vocation is that of being a teacher, and here you have Alcibiades who just doesn't get it, you know, because he just gets it wrong. So there is a certain tragic dimension to the figure of Socrates, and also a comic dimension. So this is absolutely the brilliance of Plato, is that it, rather than repudiate, he kind of recuperates and transforms the legacies of both comedy and tragedy in the dialogue form that he uses there.
Yeah. There's a lot more to Socrates than what Nietzsche says in The Birth of Tragedy, for
right,
sure.
Right, right, exactly. So, Andrew, the third part of the book, and probably the one that I find maybe the least compelling for me, is the whole Wagnerian exaltation and the way that he reads into Wagner's music some kind of revival of Greek tragedy in its original essence. What do you make of that?
Oh, I actually love it, but it is a change. It's written in a different register, I would say, than the first portions of the book. It reads a little different. It might have been added at the request of Wagner, or at least after a visit he had to Wagner's house, but it's hard to know exactly. But there, the idea is that, you know, we had originally this tragedy, ancient tragedy with Dionysus and Apollo, that corrupts and gets rationalized with Euripides and Socrates. That becomes the dominant theme of Alexandrian culture, new Attic comedy, and all these other genres arise from that, with stock characters and so forth. Things become far more formal. And this all is lauded by romance cultures. You know, the Italian rebirth of opera and French cultural dominance is all of a piece with this. We spoke about that and their presuppositions about idyllic humanity. And he wants Germany to come out from under the thumb of the French. And he sees Wagner as the one to do this, who is offering us a German art. He also praises Luther for the Reformation, which goes against, you know, the dominance of Rome and so forth. Even calls Luther's choral music a Dionysian mating call, which I don't think anyone has ever presumed before. And also seems to have little place in a work of purported philology, I would say. But Wagner is supposed to lead the German nation into refashioning itself and taking a guiding role in national existence. It's supposed to become a nation it's to cut the leading strings that the French have put on the Germans. He sees the agenda of the German state, if you will, to be exactly that of Wagner's character Siegfried, who was raised by a dwarf Mime under false pretexts, and has to break with that dwarf to go slay the dragon Fafnir, etc., etc. But Nietzsche takes that as almost literally what Germany has to do. He compares the dwarf to the French. The Germans have to do that in order to find themselves and to announce themselves on the world stage. Wagner is very much trying to create a new form of the human. His ideas of opera, this notion of the Gesamtkunstwerk, isn't just about, let's make sure we have, you know, a soundtrack and some video playing while we do this. It's also about the very institution that houses the opera, where these performances happen, has to be part of it. They have to be open to everyone. They have to have free admission. The Greeks failed at this because they had slaves. Slaves couldn't participate. We have a chance to create a more universal art form than the Greeks ever had. And then that institution of the theater that permits this is to become the model for all the other institutions of the state, of the government, where it's that the artist's world will become dominant and lead politics. You know, there's something apolitical in Dionysus, almost explicitly so. politics requires, you know, individuals that it can organize and arrange and mandate and so forth. Dionysus interrupts and dissolves individuals. Dionysus is very apolitical. This is what the Nazis hated about Nietzsche, right? They loved, like, people like Bäumler, they loved the will to power stuff and the need to expand. That's all good. But when it comes to Dionysus, that's some weird idiosyncratic religious belief of Nietzsche the man, not the thinker. Dionysus, an eternal recurrence, needs to be thrown out as just an aberration this poor guy fell into. Let's get back to will to power. You know, there's a apolitical side of Dionysus that plays here. But Nietzsche himself is using it for a nationalist purpose and one that's explicitly anti-French.
So do you think he gets Wagner right? And if yes, then what do you do with his later claims that he got it all wrong?
He goes beyond Wagner. I think he's so enamored of Wagner. And he says that he wanted to write a book that would show the world Wagner's Grecocism, his Hellenism.
Yeah.
And that people weren't aware of this. And he wanted to be like an advertisement for Wagner. He gets Wagner right, and he's trying to, you know, Wagner writes this essay in 1848, 49, Art and Revolution, where he talks about Dionysus and Apollo, and he talks about Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. And that's where we have this notion of the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art, etc. And so Nietzsche's sort of taking suggestions from that essay that Wagner didn't necessarily carry out fully and showing back to him how his operas, like Tristan and Isolde and so forth, have done that work and gone further. So he's like, he goes further than Wagner did, but tries to do it in a Wagnerian vein. Yeah. He's unfortunately a little more than a lackey. He's a creative thinker of his own right, and that shows itself, you know? And so Wagner's telling him, you know, ease off on the stuff that's moving away from my views and trying to double down a bit more on selling my points in a sense. I mean, he was literally running errands for Wagner. Wagner had some kind of gastrointestinal problems we don't have to go into, but suffice it to say he had to wear silk underwear. And so there's lots of stories of Wagner sending Nietzsche on errands to order for him from certain tailors and pick up and deliver for him silk underwear, which is hard to take in anything but a humiliating way, right? And the fact that the stories have remained for 150 years is kind of sad, and probably on his tombstone something about don't forget the underwear. But I think at a certain point, that war on him and the nationalism and just sort of the petty egoism got to him.
Yeah.
You know, no man is a hero to his valet, and Nietzsche was truly working as his valet in a certain regard, and he saw the petty egoism of Wagner, and the nationalism wears on him.
The anti-Semitism wore on him, I think, too.
Maybe. You know, one of the interesting things looking at the drafts is back in 1870 when he gave those public lectures on Greek music drama and Socrates and tragedy. The Socrates and Tragedy one ends with he has some diatribe against the contemporary press. And this is all part of this period of his thinking. It's one of the bêtes noires, is the contemporary press, which is putting jargon into the language. It's not a caretaker of the language. People aren't learning German properly. They get all these foreign words, etc., etc. And journalism is responsible. And so at the end, there's a diatribe against the contemporary press. But if you look at the earlier drafts, it said the Jewish press.
Yeah.
And Cosima Wagner writes him he sends these texts to Wagner as, you know, as a reading copy for their approval. Everything he writes at this time, he sends to Triebschen or to the place in Lucerne for their reading. And he gives them as Christmas presents to Cosima. And Cosima writes him back and says, don't say anything about the Jews, and so especially not just in passing. keep totally quiet about that. In fact, you know, it's like, you're saying the silent part out loud, Friedrich. You need to hold it back. And so then he changes that in the drafts.
Yeah.
And so I think just as in The Birth of Tragedy, there's an unspoken attack on Christianity, right? The lauding of Greek religion as being life-affirming, there's an implicit denunciation of Christianity as life-denying. So too is there perhaps a kind of implicit anti-Semitism. I think Socratic rationality becomes associated with Judaism, yeah. Semitism.
Which again, later he overcomes all that. And the case against Wagner, Nietzsche contra Wagner, all that stuff is very interesting. But since we're getting to the end, can I just ask to conclude, Andrew, what it was like for you to retranslate The Birth of Tragedy? You and I both really admire Walter Kaufmann as an amazing translator of Nietzsche, and we all owe him so much there. But what was it like for you to go back to the original German and put it into your own English?
Yeah, I mean, it's completely eye-opening. There's so many translations already of Birth of Tragedy. It's, you know, why do we need another one? I hope our translator notes make a case. But even more than that, the actual translation. You know, when I hear Nietzsche in my head, I sort of hear Kaufman's Nietzsche. The tone is perfect for me. And the tone, if you get the tone right, whatever infelicities appear in the translation, they get the benefit of the doubt. But the problem is that the tone that he uses is the tone of the mature Nietzsche, of genealogy of morals, you know, beyond good and evil. He makes this early work, or he tries to make this early work, sound more like those later works. And I think that's kind of a failing because, I mean, the book is written in this Wagnerian style, very elaborate Baroque sentences that go on for like 12 lines. And part of the Nietzsche, the complete works of Nietzsche Stanford series is to remain faithful to the form of the text. So we couldn't break sentences into two, or in most cases four, to make them, you know, easy to read. We maintain all of the clauses, even down to trying to retain his use of commas, to see this kind of frenetic way he's thinking of these just long additive sentences, and then so this. You know, Kaufman, he polishes that in a way. It's too smooth, and you sort of get what you need to know about it is this footnote he has, which is probably my favorite footnote from a translator. It comes at like section 15, where he says, the book should have ended here. Who does that? What translator just says, oh, everything else is garbage at this point, right? I mean, it's a bit of an imposition on the part of the translator, and it makes you think, maybe I'm not getting a fair account if the guy is just overtly stating this.
Yeah.
So getting back into his use of language, the rhythm of the text was what was striking. There's a way in which it almost seems when he talks about the Apollinean, the sentences are more articulated, whereas when he's talking about the Dionysian, there's more of a run to the passages, you know. It's written completely differently than the other books.
Right.
It still has this shadow of maybe a little bit of academic treatise, but it's aping Wagner's manner.
Right.
Wagner's much better at it, and Nietzsche soon abandons it, thankfully. But there's passages where he breaks out, you know, where, and these are the moments where you can't imagine any philologist doing anything but throwing the book against the wall, where he's saying, friends, put on the crown of ivy with me, and don't be surprised if leopards and tigers lay at your feet as we go join the revel, as the chariot of Dionysus draped with flowers comes by, and so forth. It's insane.
Well, I've read, you know, I reread The Birth of Tragedy in your translation. You did a great job, and we're looking forward to it, to its publication. When will it come out? Event? Do you have any idea?
I would think next year.
Next year, excellent. So we'll look forward to that. And I'm also looking forward to having you back soon, Andrew, to talk about your book, The Fourfold, or Reading the Late Heidegger, which is really astonishingly insightful, revelatory book, and I hope that you will join us to probe the depths of what you've covered in that book, okay?
Absolutely.
And so I remind our listeners, we've been speaking with Professor Andrew Mitchell, who teaches philosophy at Emory University, and we're going to have him back very soon, I hope. Take care, Andrew. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Robert. Loved it.